Good day. Today is Saturday, 8th November 2025. And before I proceed with this video, let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched and listened to the video or that part of the video that you want to watch and listen to, you've liked what you've heard and you want to indicate that fact. Now, I'm going to return to the situation in Ukraine because it seems to me that we are on the brink of dramatic developments. And the first thing to say is that there were reports circulating last night and this morning that the Ukrainian forces, what's left of them, have withdrawn almost entirely from the town of Pokrovsk and have retreated to the adjoining town or suburb to the east, which is Mirnograd. In effect, Pokrovsk is now entirely or almost entirely under Russian control. I saw a report this morning that said that Pokrovsk is 95% under Russian control. That's likely to be true. There will no doubt be some Ukrainian troops still holding positions in various parts of the town, dotted around the town, a few perhaps clustered in positions at the very northern end of the town, though that is not clear. But anyway, overall, it does seem as if the Battle of Pokrovsk itself has ended, that the Russians effectively now control Pokrovsk. And, well, we've had some indications about this from Kiev itself. Yesterday, the Ukrainian General Staff made a frankly rather cryptic announcement. Their spokesman appeared and made a statement to journalists in which he said that the Ukrainian General Staff has chosen to take certain decisions with respect to the situation in Pokrovsk. The consequences of those decisions will be made clear at some indeterminate point in the future. In order not to affect military operations, the Ukrainian General Staff cannot disclose what they are. But as soon as possible, as soon as the Ukrainian General Staff is able to provide further clarifications without compromising the security of military operations, then they will confirm, they will provide clarification and confirm what has happened. Now, I'm summarising what they say, but not by very much. And the convoluted language of the actual statement was fairly close to the convoluted language I have just used. But anyway, it seems to me that this is an elaborate way of basically telling the world and the Ukrainian people and, of course, the West that Ukraine is abandoning, the Ukrainian military is abandoning Pokrovsk, that it is retreating, withdrawing its forces, such as they are, from Pokrovsk. So, a complicated way to explain it, but it seems to me the most likely and plausible explanation of what it all means. Now, this is not the end of the battle for the Pokrovsk conurbation. The Ukrainians have withdrawn to Mirnograd. The Russian Defense Ministry has provided no comment, made no comment about any of these claims. It continues to speak of the Russians enlarging their control of Pokrovsk. And they also continue to speak of battles taking place in the adjoining villages of Gnatovka and Rog. I understand, my own understanding is that Rog is to all intents and purposes now entirely under Russian control, and Gnatovka probably also is or will very soon be. The curious aspect to this story is that what has actually happened, if this is all correct, is that the Ukrainian military has engaged in a manoeuvre to withdraw troops from one part of the Pokrovsk cauldron, the city of Pokrovsk, to another part of the Pokrovsk cauldron, which is Mirnograd. And what makes this even stranger is that the fall of Pokrovsk has, in effect, sealed even more tightly the cauldron itself and deepened the trap in which the Ukrainian troops in the Pokrovsk conurbation appear to me to be retreating too. Because, of course, with Pokrovsk now fully under or almost fully under Russian control, the territory that the Ukrainians can still maneuver through has reduced, and the exit points for the Ukrainians to use to escape from the Pokrovsk cauldron has, well, essentially vanished. And a Russian official, Igor Kimakovsky, who is a close associate of Denis Pushilin, the head of the Donetsk regional government, I should stress the Russian-backed Donetsk regional government. Anyway, he said as much. He said that the enemy can no longer leave Pokrovsk. The last route is now completely under our control. And he said this in an interview to TASS, which TASS has published this morning. And this seems to me to be obviously the case. A manoeuvre to withdraw from one part of the cauldron to another part, which seals the cauldron further shut and actually increases the distance between the Ukrainian forces in Mirnograd and any other Ukrainian forces outside the cauldron to the north and west of it. It is impossible for me to see now how the Ukrainians can even in theory retreat from Pokrovsk. Now, that brings me back to what the Ukrainian general staff was saying, their statement was saying, because could it be that someone within the Ukrainian general staff now understands the complete hopelessness of the situation in Pokrovsk, in the entire conurbation of Pokrovsk? And by releasing this very strange statement, they're also preparing the grounds for a mass surrender of Ukrainian troops in the Pokrovsk cauldron. Because that, it seems to me, is the only way now to save the lives of these people. Now, I say that because this would not just be a humane thing to do, as I've discussed in programme after programme, stretching all the way back to fairly early on in the war, to the siege of Mariupol, for example. But it would also make a kind of military sense, because, as I've discussed in recent programmes, the consistent practice is that the two sides exchange prisoners. Recently, the Russians have released far more prisoners to Ukraine than the Ukrainians have released to the Russians, which is a clear sign, by the way, that the Russians hold many more prisoners than the Ukrainians do, which is a further sign that the Russians are indeed not just advancing, but are winning the war and are inflicting heavier casualties on the Ukrainians than the Ukrainians are inflicting on the Russians. But anyway, I don't want to push this, and don't want to be sidetracked. But anyway, given that the practice up to now has been to release prisoners to the other side after a certain amount of time, someone in the Ukrainian general staff might be calculating that if the Ukrainian troops surrender and surrender to the Russians, well, the Russians will indeed win, and a notable propaganda victory, which will no doubt boost their morale, and they'll be able to film large numbers of Ukrainian prisoners being taken, columns of Ukrainian prisoners, such as we briefly saw when the Azovstal steel factory in Mariupol back in 2022 surrendered and around 2,000 Ukrainian troops surrendered in one place. Well, we could be seeing again pictures of that kind, and no doubt it will have a very bad effect on morale in Ukraine. But Ukraine, the Ukrainian military, can at least say to themselves that at some point there is a good chance that they will get their soldiers back. Just saying. Anyway, there we go. It does look to me as if we are coming now close to the end of this story. Now, it must be said that there is no sign, however, of unanimity in Kiev over this, because even as the general staff, the Ukrainian general staff, was making these very cryptic comments about the situation in Pokrovsk, Zelensky again was talking, and he was talking again in ways which suggested to me a basic detachment from reality. So firstly, Zelensky said that the whole business of Pokrovsk is a story, thereby essentially not just downplaying the situation in Pokrovsk, but sort of implying that the Russians were making it all up. And then he also said, however, in contradiction to that, that the primary reason why the Russians wanted to capture Pokrovsk was in order to impress the West, to try to get the West to back off sanctions against Ukraine, to get the West to accept the Russian view that Donbass is about to fall entirely under Russian control, and therefore it might be wise for Ukraine to cede Donbass entirely to Russia, pull its remaining troops out of Donbass, and accept perhaps, or try to negotiate, a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions with the Russians. So Zelensky remains stuck in the mental world of August to October 2025, when it appears that Witkoff and Putin, over the course of a visit Witkoff made to Moscow, agreed that the Ukrainians would withdraw from Donbass in return for the Russians stopping their advance in Zaporozhye and Kherson region. There would then be negotiations, essentially leading to an outcome very close to and perhaps identical in all other respects to Istanbul Plus. And Zelensky fiercely opposed this. He joined with his friends in Europe to insist that there could be no compromise on the territorial issue with the Russians. At most, there would be a freeze of the conflict, a ceasefire along the existing conflict lines, that Ukraine must have unrestricted rights, contrary to Istanbul Plus, to build up its armed forces to whatever level it chose in the future, that Ukraine must have an unrestricted right, in fact, an unrestricted promise to join NATO and the EU, that the Russians must be allowed no say in the matter at all, that the United States must give massive, unlimited, effectively, security guarantees to Ukraine until Ukraine had obtained its full membership of NATO, and that there'd be all the various other things that Zelensky has talked about at many times, reparations paid by Russia to Ukraine, presumably at some point, war crimes tribunals to try Russian officers and Russian political leaders, all that kind of thing. So Zelensky spoke to his allies in Europe, the British, the Germans, the French. They all joined with him. They went to the United States, to Washington, back in August. They insisted on all of this to Trump. And as we saw thereafter, in circumstances that have caused great anger in Moscow and embarrassment, personal embarrassment to Vladimir Putin, Trump appeared to go back, well, has gone back, both on the Witkoff proposal, which he seemed to endorse, and which Putin at the Alaska summit accepted, and to his own agreement that there would be a final settlement of the conflict and not a ceasefire. Trump has instead reverted back to Zelensky's formula of a ceasefire, a freeze on the existing conflict lines, with negotiations to follow indefinitely thereafter, and no commitments of any kind to be made to the in the interim about Ukraine not joining NATO, not joining the EU, and engaging in military build-ups and that kind of thing. And Trump has followed that up with talk about supplying Tomahawk missiles, or deploying, perhaps more accurately, Tomahawk long-range missiles to Ukraine. He has endorsed the narrative that, in fact, it is Ukraine which has been winning the war. He has also supported Ukraine's drone attacks on Russian refineries, and he's followed all of this up now with massive pressure on India to cease buying Russian oil and sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft. So this is what Zelensky thought he had achieved up to the end of October, that he'd managed to basically, with the help of his European friends, to pull Trump back on side. And his primary concern now, even as Pokrovsk is collapsing, the defense of Pokrovsk is collapsing, even as thousands of Ukrainian troops are surrounded, his primary concern is not with the fate of those troops, with what happens to them, but with his fear that if Pokrovsk falls or is surrendered, it will completely unwind, it will unravel what he sees as the diplomatic achievements that he made between August and October, from the time of the Alaska summit until today. Now, to my mind, this again demonstrates the cynicism, and I have to say this, the callousness of Zelensky. He continues to be obsessed by the imagery of the war, and also by the idea that the only acceptable outcome to the war is one which he wins. If he cannot win, he must lose. But there can be no compromise. There can be no concessions. No concession to reality on the battlefield. This has consistently been his mindset since the summer of 2022, and he has never shown any sign of wanting to depart from it. However many people die, however much devastation Ukraine suffers, however many soldiers' lives are lost, it remains for Zelensky more important to keep this project going, to keep the war going until perhaps through some miracle a victory is achieved and either Zelensky's position is wholly vindicated, or if it cannot be achieved, then at least there'll be presumably some kind of massive defeat, in which case at least Zelensky can claim that he was the heroic leader who defended Ukraine against the Russian hordes until the very end. This seems to be very much his mindset. The other thing I'd say about this is that, again, it shows once more the delusional nature of Zelensky's policies. Because all of these achievements, all these diplomatic achievements that I've just been talking about, that he achieved with the help of his European friends between August and the end of October, were based ultimately on a falsehood that Ukraine was holding its own, that it was, if anything, winning the war, that the Russian offensive, the Russian summer offensive, had been a failure, that the Russians, not the Ukrainians, were being worn down, and that there was therefore no real reason for Ukraine to make any concessions at all. This entire elaborate construction, all of the success on persuading Trump to reverse what he had come close to agreeing with Putin in Alaska, was based upon a situation, a vision of the situation on the battlefronts that, as we repeatedly pointed out in program after program on the Duran, but as others, Daniel Davis, Colonel McGregor, Scott of Calibrated, Brian Beletic, any number of others, as we all pointed out, had no basis in reality. In fact, and in truth, the Russian offensive continued remorselessly, was moving forward remorselessly, gaining territory and gaining positions all the time, until at the end of October, beginning of November, the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk were caught in a cauldron, and we have a similar cauldron in Kupiansk, which we'll come to shortly, and we have cauldrons probably just over the horizon in Guliapolye, in Zaporozhye region, and in Siversk, and quite probably before long in Liman too. And beyond these cauldrons, the biggest cauldron of all is now starting to appear just over the horizon, and that is the giant cauldron that, if the war continues, and Zelensky's attitude remains unchanged, will inevitably come when the Russians carry out the major encirclement that they are obviously planning of the twin cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And in addition, of course, there have been other aspects of this narrative that Zelensky has been spinning, which far too many people in the West have been buying into. Even as the Russians have been hammering Ukraine night after night with enormous missile and drone attacks of ever-growing power, Zelensky has been sending his fleets of drones to try to attack Russian oil refineries and to do damage against Russian military and energy facilities, and has achieved nothing. I say that he has achieved nothing, but in fact that isn't strictly true, because what he has done as a result of these attacks is that he has given the Russians justification for their immeasurably more powerful attacks against Ukraine's own energy transport systems. And we had further examples of this over the last 48 hours. 2 days ago, Ukraine, with its homemade drones capable of attacking with relatively small warheads, capable of moving into Russia, but unable to do much damage because the warheads are too small. Anyway, Ukraine carried out its attack against Russian facilities inside Russia. The amount of damage done, again, so far as I can tell, was barely significant. It barely scratches the surface in terms of the giant Russian energy complex and industrial economy. And then last night, Russia conducts its own enormous attack using large numbers of missiles, including Kinzhal hypersonic missiles and drone attacks against Ukraine's energy system, which, as a result of repeated Russian pounding, is already close to collapse. And last night's strike has been claimed by some people to have been the most powerful strike up to now of all. There is still a lot of assessments about this strike to make. This needs to be some more understanding of exactly how many drones, for example, Geran drones, the Russians used, and what type of drones these were. We do know that Kinzhal missiles were used, hypersonic missiles were used, and Iskander ballistic missiles were also used. And we've seen there are pictures of some of the explosions carried out on the ground, which took place on the ground as a result of the impact of these Russian missiles and drones on Ukrainian targets. There is a particularly extraordinary film of a street in the Ukrainian city of Pavlograd. Pavlograd, by the way, is a likely target for the Russian army after Pokrovsk falls. It is the next big town along the road that goes west from Pokrovsk to the Dnieper, to the city of Dnipro. Pavlograd is the city between. Anyway, there is dramatic footage of this strike on Pavlograd. You see cars driving along the main road in central Pavlograd, and behind them the sky lights up repeatedly as a result of the explosions, as the missiles and the drones, the Russian missiles and the drones, strike their targets. Ukraine cannot match this. You never see film like this as a result of any Ukrainian drone attacks, because, as I just said, the drones that Ukraine launches against Russia are homemade. Some of them are adaptations of Chinese or occasionally Western drones, though there have been a series of anguished articles in the media in the West, especially in the United States now, about the fact that American drones have not performed at all well in this conflict, in contrast to the Russian drones and to the various drones that each side has developed impromptu based on Chinese models. This is another topic to go through on some other day. But the Ukrainian drones are too small, too light. Their warheads are too small to be able to inflict significant damage on Russian industrial facilities. So, of course, we never see pictures like the one I saw yesterday, the footage I saw yesterday from the city of Pavlograd. And just to add to this, Zelensky has at various times talked up the idea of Ukraine launching its own missile attacks on Russia. There's been stories about the Sapsan missile, ballistic missile, that Ukraine was supposedly developing with assistance from Germany. The Russians claimed that they have managed to dismantle and destroy the entire Sapsan program as a result of their own missile strikes on Ukrainian industrial facilities. But Zelensky, in the last few months, has been talking a lot about the Flamingo missile. It's possible that the Flamingo missile is big, heavy, unwieldy, slow cruise missile, which does, however, have a big warhead and a long range. Anyway, it's possible that this was the missile that the Ukrainians tried to use in attacks against the chemical factory in Bryansk, about which we've heard nothing since the Ukrainians first claimed that it took place. Anyway, reports say that apart from 9 of these missiles having been launched, none of which seem to have done any significant damage, the Flamingo has stopped being used, and the reason is that the entire production base to produce these missiles in Ukraine has been destroyed, with one of the major targets being a factory which, as it happens, is located in Pavlograd, which is the only factory in Ukraine that produces the appropriate jet and rocket fuel. Quite possibly, this was the factory the Russians again attacked last night. And those extraordinary flashes that lit up the night sky over Pavlograd, which I saw in that video, they might be the impacts of strikes, missile impacts of strikes on that very same factory. So Zelensky has conducted a drone offensive against the Russian energy system, which exists mostly in terms of its effects in the imagination of the Western media there are no signs any longer of gasoline shortages in Russia. Just saying. And in return, what he has achieved is justification for these enormous, enormously more powerful Russian strikes on the Ukrainian energy complex and military industrial complex and railway system. And this is a further example of what happens when you run a war basically as a PR exercise, as a media operation. You achieve little of substance on the battlefields, but you spin narratives that you find yourself obliged to try to give reality to, and the result is destruction and disaster for your own side. Troops trapped in Pokrovsk, with Zelensky still unwilling to agree to their withdrawal or possible surrender, because that would contradict his narrative about the failure of Russia's summer offensive, and a drone campaign against Russian refineries, which inflicts slight damage, but which opens the way for the Russians to inflict immeasurably greater damage on energy targets and railway lines and industrial facilities in Ukraine. I noticed that the German arms manufacturer, Rheinmetall, has quietly dropped its plan to build a factory in Ukraine to produce weapons, shells, and that sort of thing. They're saying that the bureaucratic and regulatory obstacles to doing this have proved excessive, too great. The reality is that no factory of that kind is going to survive for very long under the kind of pounding from Russian missiles and drones that we're seeing across Ukraine night after night. So anyway, there it is. A war that Zelensky has fought largely on narratives, and he cannot drop these narratives even as reality crashes in on him. And of course, the realities aren't just in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. Similar realities are playing out elsewhere on the Ukrainian battlefields. Now, a Russian source, I think it was a Russian source, which claimed that the Russians control now 95% of Pokrovsk, says that the Russians control around 52% of Kupiansk. What I believe that actually means is the entire conurbation of Kupiansk. If we're talking about the residential area of Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol River, as far as I can see, the Russians control it entirely. The Ukrainians still control some parts of the industrial region of Kupiansk to the east of the Oskol River, though the Russians seem to have crossed that river and are fighting inside that territory. And of course, the Russians are mostly in control of the east bank of the Oskol River anyway, and have the Ukrainians surrounded from the east and north and south on that territory also. And there are, by the way, reports that the Russians are advancing from the east into the area of the cauldron as well, and are in the process of clearing certain villages that are there. And other territories which may still be under Ukrainian control, which are located on the west bank of the Oskol River, are actually, from what I can see, south of the main part of the town of Kupiansk itself, though it does seem as if the Russians have been gradually advancing southward along the west bank of the Oskol River. And yesterday, the Russian Defense Ministry gave the strong impression that it is pushing further south towards these places also. Now, as I discussed in my program yesterday, Russian commanders on the ground are now predicting that the entire Battle of Kupiansk, in other words, all of Kupiansk, the territory that the Russians currently control, the territory on the east bank of the Oskol River, the territory to the south of the central areas of Kupiansk that the Russians are now in control of, that this entire battle will end over the course of about a week. And one of those commanders again gave further information to the Russian Defense Ministry today, and he said that he has pushed the Ukrainians back from one of the last positions they hold in his sector of responsibility. And the implication is that the Russian advance in Kupiansk continues as well. So if all of this is true, then we will probably see a collapse in Kupiansk as well, perhaps in a week's time, perhaps at roughly the same time that the collapse in Mirnograd is likely to come. And then what? Will Zelensky change his stance? Will he finally recognize that the Battle of Donbass is indeed already effectively lost? Will he sack any Ukrainian generals who try to argue with this view? Will they push back and try to argue with him, even at the risk of dismissal? Or will they perhaps take further action? I don't know, but it does seem to me that we are now in a major inflection point in this war. Now, to give an example of how things are changing, I'm just going to make a comparison with another siege of another town that took place in Ukraine. This is, or rather village that took place in Ukraine. This is the village of Novomikhailovka, located to the east of Kurakhovo and to the north of Ugledar. This is an important village because it lay close to the road that provided the major supplies to Ugledar, the fortress town of Ugledar in southern Donbass, the major supply route to this town from the north. And the Russians began an operation to capture Novomikhailovka, which was a city, a village of around 1,500 people before the war. They began it in the autumn of 2023. And Novomikhailovka was ferociously defended by the Ukrainian brigade that was located there. And it took the Russians around 6 months to capture it. Novomikhailovka finally fell in April 2024. And if you look back to other sieges of villages and towns that took place at about the same time, places like Krasnogorovka, for example, a small town close to Donetsk city. Well, the battles for these places were almost as prolonged and sometimes even more prolonged than the battle for Novomikhailovka. Contrast that situation with what has just happened in Pokrovsk, a much bigger place than Novomikhailovka, on an entirely different scale. And the Russians have captured it, by my calculations, in around 8 to 10 weeks. It's been much faster tempo. And of course, the Russians haven't just captured Pokrovsk over this same period. They made further advances in Zaporozhye region. Yesterday, the Russian Defense Ministry confirmed, for example, that the village of Uspenovka, village similar in some respects to Novomikhailovka, roughly the same scale, also heavily fortified, that village was captured after a fight there that lasted roughly a week. And a little further to the north, in Dnipropetrovsk region, the Russians are now apparently fighting inside another village, Novopavlivka, and most estimates are that this village will also be captured by the Russians in about a week. Novopavlivka, twice the size of Novomikhailovka, also heavily fortified, also important, an important barrier protecting key supply roads, and yet it looks as if the Russians will capture it so much faster than they were able to capture Novomikhailovka back in 2023-2024. Something fundamental has changed in the war. The Russians are advancing much more quickly than they were. Obviously, they have grown better and bigger. The Ukrainians probably are not as good as they were, and they have grown smaller. And there is every reason to think, with the fall of Pokrovsk, with the imminent fall of Mirnograd, with the imminent fall of Kupiansk, that the tempo of the various Russian advances across the entire conflict line is now going to accelerate. Now, I mentioned the situation in Zaporozhye. The fall of Uspenovka opens now the way for the Russians to continue to advance eastwards towards the city of Zaporozhye. There are growing indications that the important town of Guliapolye will soon be encircled unless the Ukrainians are wise enough to withdraw from it, which, of course, Zelensky is never going to do. There's been less news recently about what's going on in Liman and Siversk, which is probably, by the way, a sign of intensifying fighting in these places. But it looks like the Russians have been steadily increasing the ground they control inside the key town of Konstantinovka, bigger place than Pokrovsk, which lies to the east of Pokrovsk and which lies south of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. Anyway, the Russians continue to advance. They continue to pound Ukraine. Their economy is stable. They provided further economic data over the last few hours, which show further inflation falls. The ruble, for the moment at least, looks surprisingly stable. Their oil exports continue to hold up, though I believe that that is an overstated and exaggerated story. As I discussed in my program yesterday, Ukraine's creditors are starting to have major doubts about continuing to roll over or restructure Ukrainian debt. The Europeans are having cold feet about the asset confiscation plan, the Russian asset confiscation plan. There was apparently another meeting between the European Commission and the Belgian government yesterday to talk about that plan, but it doesn't seem to have gone anywhere. And, well, the IMF is now having further doubts about whether to continue its financial programme of support for Ukraine as well. Now, on this last point, by the way, and perhaps there's something I ought to add to what I have previously said about the IMF programme of supporting Ukraine. I said in a recent programme that given that Ukraine essentially defaulted back in 2014, defaulted on a loan it owed to Russia, which is a member of the Paris Club, and which therefore should have prohibited the IMF, according to its own rules, from continuing to lend to Ukraine. If countries default on loans owed to members of the Paris Club, that supposedly, under the IMF rules, prohibits further lending, further IMF lending. Anyway, I've mentioned this point. I've said that it was incredible to me that the IMF continued to lend money to Ukraine, despite the fact that Ukraine went into default in 2014. And that the IMF has thrown away tens of billions of dollars of Western taxpayers' money on its support program for Ukraine. But what I did not mention is that one of the reasons why private creditors have been lending to Ukraine since 2014 is because they've had the assurance that the IMF was lending to Ukraine also. The private lenders, many of the private lending agencies, the banks, the financial institutions, will have taken the fact that Ukraine was in agreement with the IMF on a borrowing program as a sign that Ukraine was financially solvent, or at least financially responsible, and was a country worth lending to. One can argue whether that was a wise decision, but if you know how lending strategies by these institutions are formed, you can see how it might have happened. Now, all of these lenders must be feeling privately very angry with the IMF and with its Western backers for leading them up the garden path, leading them to continue to lend to a bankrupt country, which is Ukraine, which now looks like it is on the brink of financial collapse and possible hyperinflation. Governments and institutions that engage in this kind of lending to obviously bankrupt nations, I think, don't always understand the full implications of what they do. President Trump's decision, for example, to continue to support President Milei of Argentina to the tune of $20 billion is a further case in point. I wonder whether some of these lenders might take legal action over this with respect to Ukraine in future. I'm not saying they can. Maybe there are legal obstacles to doing it. Maybe they won't because of the risks they might run if they were to do such a thing. But it does seem to me that on the face of it, it would be at least possible, in which case we might see Christine Lagarde, who was the head of the IMF at the time when the critical lending decisions were made in 2014 and 2015, and who is now, of course, the president of the European Central Bank, having to turn up in court to explain some of her decisions. Anyway, there we go. Now, I've discussed the military situation, which, as I said, it seems to me conclusively demolished these false narratives that Zelensky has been circulating over the course of the summer, and which disastrously were believed by sections of the media in the West, and which were regurgitated by various US officials and political leaders, people like Kellogg, Waltz, Rubio, Radcliffe, and others. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, now does seem to be having doubts, serious doubts, about where all of this is going. Yesterday in the United States, he met with the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, and they discussed various things. And of course, President Trump was also publicly questioned by the media about the situation in Ukraine. And it seemed to me that there was a significant shift in tone. Trump, again, seemed to be talking about the possibility one day of a summit meeting between himself and Putin. And he gave the clear impression that, well, he said that the meeting, if it did take place, should happen in Budapest, in the Hungarian capital, the capital of the country that he's guest, of which he's guest, Viktor Orban, is prime minister. He also finally did that thing which he owes to Orban as a friend. He announced that Hungary will indeed receive sanctions relief from the United States. It can continue to buy oil and gas from Russia. President Trump still spoke very negatively about the fact that the rest of the European Union is able to buy oil and gas, continues to buy oil and gas from Russia. But he's agreed that his friend Viktor Orban can continue to do so on behalf of Hungary. Up to now, and I have to say this, Trump has treated Orban extremely badly, but this seems to have finally hit home with him, and he's finally thrown to Orban a lifeline. And it was all the various things that Trump said about the situation in Ukraine, the conflict in Ukraine, that really struck me. Firstly, he went, I think, further than he has ever done to make it clear that the war between Ukraine and Russia, is not only Biden's war, but it is the war that Biden willed, that Biden essentially engineered the war. That, it seemed to me, was the clear implication of Trump's words, that Biden engineered the war, disregarding the fact that he was creating a war, engineering a war between Ukraine and a very much bigger, far more powerful country, which is, of course, Russia. And Trump spoke about how this has been very bad for Ukraine, how it's lost a fifth of its territory, how it might lose more, how this is causing enormous damage to Ukraine. He did say, he was careful to say that this wasn't good for Russia either, but he did seem to me to be implying that the war was turning out far worse for Ukraine than it is for Russia. It looks like a change in tone from the tone that we have heard from Trump over the last few months, in which he has been talking mostly about his disappointment with Vladimir Putin, has, as I said, floated the ideas of deploying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, again demanded a freeze of the conflict, and imposed sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft after calling a summit meeting with Putin in Budapest off. So it did look to me like a significant change of tone. And in fact, and the very fact that Trump had this meeting with Orban at all, after all that's happened over the last few months, also suggested to me that some kind of fence mending operation was underway. And I wonder whether Trump might also be seeking Orban's help to try to repair damage, the damage that has been done with the Russians. Now, quite likely, if Trump is asking Orban for help, then Orban will try to provide that help. Orban is somebody who can count on a friendly and courteous reception in Moscow, and who the Russians do listen to. But I have to say that if Orban goes to Moscow now with the idea that he can persuade the Russians to return to the Witkoff formula of August, a Ukrainian pullout from Donbass in return for a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, then I'm afraid that he will probably find that he is on stony ground. I think that the moment for that idea has probably passed, and the Russians, he may also find that the Russians are unconvinced that any agreement they make with Trump will stick, or that an agreement with Trump at this point is worthwhile. Again, probably the only way that the Russians can perhaps be persuaded to re-establish contacts with the Americans is if the Americans agree to broaden the agenda, to look at questions of arms control, to look at questions of economic cooperation, of course, but arms control, far more important at this time, as I've discussed at length in my last two videos, with the Americans perhaps proposing confidence-building measures, and this time sticking to those proposals. And perhaps the Americans also calling off whatever operation they have in mind in Venezuela. But more importantly, perhaps, than any of that, finally making clear-cut public statements that Ukraine will not join NATO today or tomorrow or ever, and that this is the policy of the US government, and that the United States is prepared to enter into binding agreements with the Russians to agree to that. Even then, I suspect it will be a very, very tall order. If you throw away your chance for an agreement, the kind of agreement that the Russians were prepared to agree to in August, if you throw it away, you may find that if you come back when the situation has deteriorated so significantly to your disadvantage, you may find that your partner in the negotiation is no longer interested in going back in time in that kind of way. Anyway, there we are. We shall see what happens. I don't myself entertain many hopes about a diplomatic compromise anymore. I think there would be enormous opposition to it in Moscow. I think that probably Russian objectives are going to start expanding very soon. I think the terms for a deal are probably beyond Trump's reach now. Anyway, we shall see. We shall see what happens. Now, further reasons why the president might be well advised to try at least, even if he can't get a deal done with the Russians over Ukraine, to try to find some means to lessen tensions. I mean, you could make small steps, but important small steps, like restoring air links, for example. One of the reasons is that it seems to me that the situation is deteriorating globally, both for the United States and for him. I've discussed extensively in my recent programs the technological breakthrough that the Russians have achieved in developing miniature nuclear reactors such that they can place on missiles like the Burevestnik and underwater drones like the Poseidon drone, and such as they are apparently intending to use in their space program, in their heavy lift rocket, and in all sorts of other potentially civilian applications as well. Arnaud Bertrand has recently written a very interesting article on his Substack blog about Chinese potential development of a thorium reactor in China. Now, this is an altogether much bigger reactor. The point is that it works in significantly different ways from the pressurized water reactors that are the reactors that are used mostly around the world. And, well, I do wonder whether, again, Chinese developments in what one might describe as big reactors, thorium reactors, which come with all kinds of advantages that Arnaud Bertrand sets out at length and in detail, whether Chinese advances in thorium reactors, which have moved so far that we are perhaps almost on the brink of seeing serial production of such reactors take place. Well, whether Chinese advances in thorium reactors and Russian advances in what are almost certainly liquid-cooled miniature reactors might not very soon complement each other. China and Russia cooperate in many areas, certainly in areas of technology and nuclear engineering. Rosatom is heavily involved in the Chinese civil nuclear program. And, well, I'm confident that the Russians will share their miniature nuclear reactor technology with China. And I strongly expect, indeed I am confident, that the Chinese will share with the Russians their thorium reactor technology in return. I'm starting to think that one of the major wrong turns that the West has taken over the last 30 years is that under the pressure of, well, let's say it straightforwardly, green movements, it turned so decisively against nuclear power, so that the big technological breakthroughs here are being done by the Chinese and the Russians. And I say this because I suspect that alternative energy sources, wind and solar, probably have finite limits, which will one day be achieved. Whereas it seems to me that if we're talking about nuclear power engineering, thorium reactors and liquid cooled reactors and all of that, well, there is no finite point at all. And for the moment, at least, it seems to me that at least in Europe, the political obstacles to developing nuclear power remain all but insurmountable. France's nuclear industry, which used to be enormous, is apparently very run down. France still produces an enormous amount of its energy from nuclear reactors, but this is a legacy from other times, and it seems that some of these reactors are now becoming old and run down and will probably before long start to close. Germany has just completed demolition, or so I understand, of one of its last reactors. In Britain, there's been various plans and projects to move forward with nuclear power. One of them involved Chinese investment and Chinese technology, but that looks like it's been abandoned. The British engineering firm Rolls-Royce was also talking about miniature reactors at one time, but I haven't heard much about this for a while, and as far as I can see, that those developments, well, perhaps they haven't completely stalled, but they don't seem to be moving especially fast. And to be frank, the technology doesn't seem as revolutionary as the technology, the recent breakthroughs achieved by the Russians. And in theory, in the United States, the situation should be better, but it doesn't look to be that much better there either. And to repeat again, it's often said that in the great new world of AI, which some are promising, one needs immeasurably enormous quantities of power, that just developing the chips and the programs is not going to be enough because the levels of power consumption are so enormous. And it seems to me that the Chinese and the Russians are running way ahead on almost every front of the West in this category, with the Russians, incidentally, also moving forward rapidly to gasify their country, to provide heating across Russia using natural gas. Anyway, there it is. We've had, of course, also the various military developments that I've discussed, the Burevestnik, the Poseidon, the new Khabarovsk-class submarine. I saw that China is just rolling out its latest big aircraft carrier. Again, I'm not sure how viable aircraft carrier technology is, but suffice to say that China is able to build aircraft carriers at speeds which would be unthinkable for the United States. And, well, the Russians, for their part, are now producing, as I discussed in a recent program, nuclear submarines in large numbers too. So the balance is shifting against the United States, and there's been a recent big wobble in the American stock markets. And I was reading, there was an, I think it was Naked Capitalism, an excellent article about how depressed parts of the American economy are, and the extent to which this fact has been disguised but cannot be written away by the stock market bubble, the recent AI stock market bubble. So, all of this, it seems to me, does indeed suggest that the president and his officials really ought to follow the advice of the vice president, J.D. Vance, and focus on domestic matters. I doubt that they will. I don't think that they can. I don't think they have any idea, really, how to do it. And I doubt that this president knows how to make the compromises that are needed. I will finish by saying that there was an interesting article in Reuters which spoke about the steps that the Chinese are taking, supposedly, to relax their export controls on rare earths. As the article admitted, these fall well short of what President Trump might have wanted. From what I could see reading the article, the changes that the Chinese are doing are purely cosmetic. Chinese controls on rare exports of rare earths and rare earth technologies are probably going to toughen, not relax. And I had a very interesting private email from an engineer who has been involved in rare earth technology, and specifically one amongst the many types of rare earths. And he told me that he had been involved in a crash program to try to develop the necessary refining technology. This was a program that was pushed very hard, and that program took 10 years to achieve fruition. So, when you put it all together, it seems to me, as I said, that the odds are stacking up. And of course, on top of that, beyond that, we're probably going to see a massive military crisis play out in Ukraine over the winter. Russian offensives do continue in the winter. The winter has never stopped the Russian army. There's no reason to think it will this winter either. 2026 is starting to look like a very difficult year. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.